Fletch by Gregory MacDonald. Copyright 1974 by the author. This recording of the reading of Fletch was published by arrangement with Gregory MacDonald and was produced in 1988 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. You may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they are all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Unless you are at home during the day, you will probably find it more convenient to have tapes mailed to you at your business address rather than your home. Reason is that postmen cannot leave packages if no one is there to receive them. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, call us at our regular customer service number. Give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Fletch by Gregory MacDonald. This book consists of 32 chapters and is 253 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Irwin Fletcher, a down-and-out beach bum among the drug-ridden human wreckage on a sunny California beach. Except that Fletch is a crack undercover reporter hot on the trail of the most sensational story of his career. Until millionaire industrialist Alan Stanwyck makes him an offer his reporter's instincts won't let him turn down. Commit a murder, collect a safe full of cash, board a plane to Buenos Aires, and live like a king on a dead man's money. The catch? The victim is Stanwyck himself. And Fletch has just 7 days to find out why a guy who has everything wants to throw it all away. Day by day, minute by minute, Fletch races across a sprawling canvas of California-style decadence and electrifying human intrigue toward a stunning, unguessable climax. Dedication to Susie, Judy, and Lou Clapp. Chapter 1. What's your name? Fletch. What's your full name? Fletcher. What's your first name? Irwin. What? Irwin. Irwin Fletcher. People call me Fletch. Irwin Fletcher, I have a proposition to make to you. I will give you $1,000 for just listening to it. If you decide to reject the proposition, you take the $1,000, go away, and never tell anyone we talked. Fair enough? Is it criminal? I mean, what do you want me to do? Of course. Fair enough. For $1,000, I can listen. What do you want me to do? I want you to murder me. The black shoes tainted with sand came across the oriental rug. The man took an envelope from an inside pocket of his suit jacket and dropped it into Fletcher's lap. Inside were 10 $100 bills. The man had returned the second day to the seawall to watch Fletch. Only 30 yards away, he used binoculars. The third day, he met Fletch at the beer stand. I want you to come with me. Why? I want to make you an offer. I'm not that way. Neither am I. There's a job I might like to have you do for me. Why can't we talk here? This is a very special job. Where are we going? To my house. I'll want you to know where it is. Do you have any clothes on the beach? Just a shirt. Get it. My car's a gray Jaguar XKE, parked at the curb. I'll be waiting in it for you. I want to drink my beer first. Bring it with you. You can drink it in the car. Walking away through the beach crowd, the man looked as out of place in his dark business suit as an insurance adjuster at a jalopy jamboree. No one appeared to notice him. Keeping his shirt over it, Fletch picked up the plastic bag off the sand. He sat a few feet away from his group, his shirt over the plastic bag beside him. Looking at the ocean, he drank some of the beer he held in his left hand. With his right hand, he dug a hole in the sand under his shirt. What's happening? Bobby asked. She was belly down on a towel. Thinking. He put the plastic bag into the hole and covered it over with sand. I guess I'm splitting, he said, for a while. Will you be back tonight? I don't know. Slinging his shirt over his shoulder, he started away. Give me a swallow before you go. Bobby jacked herself on her elbow and took some of the beer. That's good, she said. Hey, man, Creasy said. Fletch said, splitting, too much sun. The license plate of the car was 440001. In the car, Fletch sat with a can of cold beer between his knees. The man drove smoothly and silently. Below sunglasses, the man's face was expressionless. On his left hand was a college ring. He used a gold cigarette lighter from his jacket pocket rather than the dashboard lighter. In the shorefront traffic, the air conditioner was making the car cold. Fletch opened the window. The man turned the air conditioner off. He took the main road going north from town and accelerated. The car cornered beautifully on the curves going up into the hills. He slowed, turned left on Hawthorne, then right on Berman Street. The house was what made Berman Street a dead end. If it weren't for signs on the iron-grilled gate saying private property, no trespassing, Stanwyck, the road would appear to continue straight onto the driveway. There were 2 acres of lawn on each side of the driveway in front of the house. Fletch threw his beer can through the window onto the lawn. The man did not appear to notice. The house was built like a southern mansion, with white pillars before a deep veranda. The man closed the door to the library behind them. Why do you want to die? The envelope weighed little in the palm of Fletch's right hand. I'm facing a long, ugly, painful, uncertain death. How so? A while ago I was told I have cancer. I've had it checked and had it rechecked. It's terminal. Non-operable, non-treatable cancer. You don't look it. I don't feel it. A kind of general rottenness. It's in its early stages. The docs say it will be a while before it's noticeable to others. Then it will move very swiftly. How long will it take? They say 3 months, maybe 4. Not 6 months, anyway. From what they say, I would guess in a month from now I won't be able to conceal that I have it. So, a month's a month. When you make a decision like this, that you're going to be dead, you decide to do it as quickly, as soon as possible. You try to cut the dying time. Hands behind his back, the man was facing the French windows. Fletch guessed he was in his early 30s. Why don't you kill yourself? Why do you need me? My company has me insured for $3 million. I have a wife and child. There's no point in losing the money, which I would, or rather my heirs would, if I committed suicide. On the other hand, for $3 million, it's not worth going through that much pain and unpleasantness. I believe I've made an entirely rational decision. The paintings in the room were not particularly good, in Fletch's opinion, but they were real. Why me? You're a drifter. You suddenly showed up in town. You just as suddenly leave. No one will think about it in particular or connect you with the murder. There will be no way of connecting you and me. You see, I've planned your escape. It's very important to me that you escape. If you were caught and talked, as you would, the insurance would be voided. Supposing I'm not a drifter. Supposing I'm just on vacation. Is that what you're telling me? That you're on vacation? No. I've been watching you off and on the last few days. You're on the beach with the dregs of society. You associate exclusively with drug addicts. I must assume you are one yourself. Maybe I'm a cop. Are you? No. You have a deep body tan, Erwin Fletcher. You're as skinny as an alley cat. The soles of your feet are calloused. You've been on the road a long time. Why did you pick me over the other kids on the beach? You're no kid. You look younger, but you're almost 30. I'm 29. You're not as far gone as the others. You're addicted, I suppose, otherwise you couldn't stand to live with those freaks, but you still seem to operate. I'm a fairly reliable-looking drifter. Don't feel complimented. Fletch said, what makes you think I want to commit murder? $20,000, and a guarantee you won't get caught. After staring out the window, it took the man's eyes a moment to adjust to the room. He was unable to look at Fletch without an expression of mild disgust. You can't tell me you don't need money. Addicts always need money, even beginners. Maybe your taking this opportunity will prevent your committing more genuine crimes. Why isn't this a genuine crime? It's a mercy killing. Are you married? I have been, Fletch said, twice. And now you're on the road. From where are you originally? Seattle. So you commit an act of mercy, make some money, and split. What's wrong with that? I don't know. I'm not sure. Are you ready for more? More what? More of the plan. Or are you ready to quit? I'm ready. Go ahead. I want to die next Thursday, a week from tonight, at about 8:30. It should look like the usual murder-robbery scene. The servants will be out, as they are now, and my wife will be at a committee meeting at the Rackets Club. These French windows will be unlocked. The damned servants always forget to lock them anyway. He swung the door open and closed it with his hand. I used to complain about it until I realized their stupidity could be useful. At the moment, we do not have a dog. I'll be in this room alone waiting for you. I will already have opened the safe, and in it will be $20,000 in tens and twenties, which will be yours after you have murdered me. I don't imagine opening a safe is one of your skills. No. Too bad. It would look better if it were authentically burglarized. At least be sure to wear gloves. I don't want you to get caught. In the drawer here, he said, reaching inside the top right-hand desk drawer, is a gun which is always loaded. It was a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson. The man showed him that it was loaded. I figure you should use my gun so no one can trace it to you. Before you come, I will mess up the house a bit to indicate robbery. The trick will be to make it look as if I've caught you at burglary. You have already been in my desk. You have my gun, you shoot me. Can you shoot? Yes. Were you in the service? Yes, Marines. Either the head or the heart. Just make it quick and painless, and for Christ's sake, make sure you're thorough. Do you have a passport? No, Fletch lied. Of course not. Get one. That should be the first order of business, as that will take time. It's not tourist season, so it shouldn't take more than 3 or 4 days, but get started tomorrow. After you murder me, you will drive the Jaguar, which will be parked out front, to the airport. Leave the car in the Transworld Airlines parking lot. You will be taking the 11 o'clock flight to Buenos Aires. I will make the reservation and pay for it in your name tomorrow. I figure $20,000 should buy you some fun in Buenos Aires for a year or two. $50,000 would buy me even more fun. You want $50,000? Murder doesn't cost that much. You forget you're to be the victim. You want it done humanely. The man's eyes narrowed contemptuously. You're right, of course. I guess $50,000 can be arranged without causing suspicion. The man returned to stare through the French windows. Clearly, he did not like looking at Fletch. I'm doing everything I can to guarantee that you don't get caught. All you have to remember are gloves and a passport. The gun will be provided, and a seat on the plane will be reserved and prepaid. The man asked, "Will you murder me?" Fletch said, "Sure." Chapter 2. Clara? Where are you, Fletcher? I'm in a phone booth. Are you all right? Sure. I was afraid of that. I love you too, bitch. Endearments will get you nowhere. There's nowhere I want to get with you. Listen, I'm driving up tonight. To the office? Yes. Why? I think I'm onto something interesting. Does it have to do with the drugs on the beach story? As a matter of fact, no. Then I don't want to hear about it. I'm not going to tell you about it anyway. Frank was asking for the drug beach story again this afternoon. Fuck Frank. He wants it, Fletcher. That's scheduled as a major magazine story, and you were supposed to be in with it 3 issues ago. I'm doing fine with it. He wants it now, Fletcher. With pictures. Frank was pretty boiled this afternoon, and you know how much I love you. You'd stick up for me, wouldn't you, Clara? In a pig's ass. You can't take me off the story now, and Frank knows it. I've got too much time in on it. Besides, no one else in the office has my tan. What we can do is fire you for failure to complete an assignment. Why don't you stop talking, Clara? I said I'm driving up tonight. There are some people who are just too goddamned obnoxious to have around. Meaning me? Which reminds me, Fletcher, another sleazy lawyer was around the office again this afternoon looking for you. Something about non-payment of alimony. Which wife this time? How the hell do I know? Don't you pay either of them? They both wanted to be free of me. They're both free. But the court says you're not free of them. When I want legal advice, Clara, I'll ask. Keep those bums out of the office. Your alimony problems are not our problems. Right, Clara. And don't come back here until you have that goddamn story done. I can miss a day with the little darlings. I sort of told the kids I was splitting anyway, for a while. I can get back here by tomorrow night and have another wonderful weekend on the beach. I said no, Fletcher. If you've accomplished anything at all down there, you must have caused some curiosity. Going for your car now and driving up to the office would just expose everything. You shouldn't even be in a phone booth talking to me. I want to come up to make some phone calls and do some digging. On this story, the beach one? No, the other one. We don't give a damn about any other story until you finish this one. Clara, I'm cold. I'm still in swimming trunks. I care. Get off the phone and get doing what you're supposed to be doing. It's 7:30 and I've had a long day. Bye, Clara. Nice talking with you. Don't get any crumbs in Frank's bed. Prick. Running on the beach warmed him. The setting sun made his shadow gigantic, his strides seem enormous. There were people still on the beach, as there always were these days. Taking off his shirt as he ran made his shadow on the sand look as if he were Big Bird trying to take off. Near Fat Sam's lean-to, he threw his shirt on the sand and sat beside it. His aim had been perfect. Under the shirt, he dug up the plastic bag. His fingers told him that the camera was still inside. With the bag wrapped in his shirt, Fletch ambled back along the beach to the residential section. The houses became more spacious and the distances between them greater. A checkbook was on the sand. Fletch picked it up. Merchants Bank. No depositor's name was printed on the checks, but there was an account number and a balance of $785.34. Fletch stuck the checkbook into a back pocket of his sawed-off blue jeans. A man stoking a barbecue pit yelled at him as he cut through a backyard. Fletch gestured at him in Italian. He picked up his keys in the office and padded over the grease-packed garage floor to where his MG was parked. In the trunk were long jeans and a sweater. "Hey, jerk!" The guy in the office was fat and bald. "You can't change your pants in here. You can't strip in a public place." "I did." "Wise ass, what if some ladies were around?" "There are no ladies in California." He flicked on the tape recorder before he left the garage. The safety belt strapped the big tape recorder to the passenger seat. He had put the camera in the glove compartment. The wire was draped around his neck. The microphone dangled beneath his chin. "Alan Stanwyck," he said, waving as he passed a man still shouting at him from the office. "After keeping me under surveillance a few days while I've been investigating the source of drugs in the beach area for the News Tribune, has just commissioned me to murder him in exactly 1 week, next Thursday night at 8:30. His surveillance convinced him that I am in fact a drifter and a drug addict. At least I think it is Alan Stanwyck who has commissioned me to murder him. I'd never seen Alan Stanwyck before, but the man who commissioned me to murder him brought me to the Stanwyck residence on Berman Street, the hills. I know there is such a person as Alan Stanwyck, as Amelia Shercliffe of the News Tribune doubtlessly has referred to him 1,000 times. Alan Stanwyck, the wealthy young socialite. A quick check of the picture files at the office will establish whether or not the man who commissioned me to murder him is in fact Alan Stanwyck. I must follow the journalistic instinct of being skeptical of everything until I personally have proved it true. Stanwyck's justification for this unique request, that I murder him, is that he is dying of cancer. I am without any diagnostic training, but I must say that to a layman's eye, he looks a well and fit man. On the other hand, his manner is totally convincing. Further, justification for the request is that his life is insured for $3 million. Direct and obvious suicide on his part would nullify the insurance. The man who says he is Stanwyck says he has a wife and child. The plan he has worked out for his murder is detailed. Having a passport, I am to enter the Stanwyck house through the French windows in the library next Thursday evening at 8:30. His wife will be at a committee meeting at the Rackets Club. The servants will be gone. Stanwyck will have arranged the house to make it appear a robbery has been committed. He will have opened the safe. I'm to take a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson from the top right-hand drawer of the desk in the library and shoot Stanwyck to kill him as painlessly as possible. He has shown me that the gun is loaded. I'm then to drive his car, a gray Jaguar XKE, license number 440001, to the airport and board the TWA 11 o'clock flight to Buenos Aires. A reservation in my name for that flight will be made tomorrow. For this service to Stanwyck, he has agreed to pay me $50,000. He will have the cash in the house, in the open safe, in tens and twenties when I arrive next week. Originally, he offered $20,000. I pressed the price to $50,000 in an effort to gauge his seriousness. He appeared serious. His investigation of me he believes to have been adequate. He watched me a few days and saw precisely that image I had been assigned to project, that of a drifter and a drug addict. He did not know my name or anything else about me. What Stanwyck doesn't realize is that I am the great hotshot young reporter, I am Fletcher of the News Tribune, who so dislikes his first names, Irwin Maurice, that he never signs them. I am Fletcher, down at the beach trying to break a drug story. The questions at this point appear obvious enough. Is the man who commissioned me to murder him Alan Stanwyck? Does he have terminal cancer? Is he insured for $3 million? Does he really mean for me to murder him? In the answer to any one of these questions, there is probably a hell of a story. And although I admit to having been in the killing business for a while in Indochina, I am now back in the hell of a story business. Any story concerning Alan Stanwyck is worth getting. Therefore, I have agreed to murder Alan Stanwyck. My agreeing to murder him gives me exactly a week in which I can be fairly sure he will not commission anyone else to murder him. Dishonest of me, I know, but as Pappy used to say about violating virgins, son, if you're not the first, someone else will be. Chapter 3. Carradine, this is I.M. Fletcher. Yes, Mr. Fletcher. I write for the News Tribune. Oh. You are the financial editor, aren't you? Are you that shit who wrote that piece saying we are headed for a moneyless state? I did write something of the sort, yes. You're a shit. Thanks for buying the Sunday paper. I didn't. I read it Monday in the office. You see? What can I do for you, Fletcher? A head peered through the door of Fletcher's cubicle and smiled victoriously. The head was about 40 years old, male, with bleached blonde hair. Seeing Fletch on the telephone, it withdrew. I need some information about a man named Stanwyck, W-Y-K. Alan Stanwyck? Yes. The picture file on Fletch's desk was clearly of the man he had met yesterday. Alan Stanwyck in business suit, Alan Stanwyck in black tie, Alan Stanwyck in flight gear, Alan Stanwyck who wished to end his life. A murder mystery. He married Collins Aviation. All of it? He married the only daughter of the president and chairman of the board. Job security. You should be so lucky. Frank, our supreme boss, doesn't have any daughters, just sons of bitches. I believe Stanwyck is executive vice president of Collins Aviation. Will wonders never cease? I believe he's due to be president once he gets a little more age on him. His future was made with the bed. No, I understand he's a competent fellow in his own right. Graduated from Harvard or Wharton, one of those places. A bright fellow who, as far as I know, is a perfectly nice man. How is Collins Aviation doing? Very well, as far as I know. He runs a place. His father-in-law is virtually retired. Spends all his time running tournaments at the Rackets Club down at the beach and paying for them. The stock is solid. I don't know. I'd really have to look into it more. It's not a very active stock. It's publicly traded, but mostly it's held by Collins and a few of his cronies who are directors. So anything could be true, huh? Almost anything. You want me to look further into this? Yes. What do you need to know? Everything. I want to know everything about Stanwyck, his wife, Collins, Collins Aviation, personal and professional. Why the Christ should I do your work for you? You're the financial editor of the News Tribune, aren't you? Yes. I'd hate to make a mistake and have it reflect on you. Me? How could it reflect on me? I've talked with you already. Clara Snow said you're a shit. My extension is 705. Many thanks. Christ. No, I am Fletcher. The telephone book was stuffed into the bookcase behind his desk. While he was pulling it out, ignoring the papers that spilled on the floor from above and below the telephone book, the man who was not blonde came in and sat down in Fletcher's side chair. Mr. Fletcher. The man wore an open shirt and love beads. Yes? I'm Gillette of Gillette, Worsham & O'Brien. No foolin'. Your wife's attorneys. Which wife? Mrs. Linda Fletcher, as she is now known. Oh, really, Linda, how's she doing? Not well, Mr. Fletcher, not well at all. I'm sorry to hear that. She's a nice kid. She's very distressed that since the divorce you have not paid her one cent in alimony. I took her to lunch once. She has told me about the king-size relish burger several times now. Your generosity has been marked. The alimony you owe her is $3,429. Because of your generosity regarding the king-size relish burger, the few odd cents can be forgotten. Thanks. Collins Aviation, 553-0477. Tell me something, Mr. Worsham. Gillette. As an attorney, I mean. I would not be allowed to have you as a client. I might add that I would not want you as a client. Nevertheless, there you are, sitting in a chair in my office, determined not to be thrown out while I'm trying to get some work done. I know you come from a very distinguished law firm. Only partners of the most distinguished law firms come out personally to collect bills for $3,000. You've been hanging around all week. It must be that your own office rent isn't paid. Or are you nicking Linda for more than 300 of the 3,000? What is your question, Mr. Fletcher? As an attorney, Mr. Gillette, do you think it makes any difference that I never agreed to any alimony settlement? I've never even agreed to the divorce. I have nothing to do with that now. The court decided that you should pay, and you shall. I mean, doesn't it strike you as peculiar that I came home one night and Linda wasn't there, and the next thing I know I'm divorced for abandoning her? This is not the first time this has happened to you, Mr. Fletcher. For a boy in your early or mid-20s, two divorces on your record seem more than adequate. I'm sentimental. I keep believing in the old institutions. As long as you keep getting married, I promise I won't get married anymore. Being abandoned is too expensive. Mr. Fletcher, Mrs. Fletcher has told me a great deal about you. Did you ever buy her a king-size relish burger? We've talked in my office. I thought so. She's told me that you are a vicious, violent man, a liar, and a cheat, and that she left your bed and board because she absolutely couldn't stand you anymore. She did not abandon you. She escaped with her life. Vicious and violent. Bullshit! One night I stepped on the cat's tail. You pitched the cat through the window of your seventh-floor apartment. The whole place smelled of cat. Mrs. Fletcher, thinking reasonably that she might be the next one to go through the window, packed and left the very next time you left the apartment to go to work. Nonsense. She didn't smell. She was always in the shower. She washed her hair every half hour. Mr. Fletcher, as you have pointed out, I've been looking for you all week. For some reason, your office would not let me know where you were. I have the choice of bringing you back to court, and this time I assure you will appear. Now, do you wish to arrange to make this payment here and now, or do you force me to go back to court? Easier done than said. From his desk drawer, Fletch took the checkbook he had found on the beach, the Merchant's Bank. It just so happens, Mr. Gillette, that I've been playing poker all week. I won $7,000. That's why my office didn't know where I was, of course. I deposited the money last night, if you would just take this check and hold it for 10 days. Certainly. That would leave me enough for taxes and to get the car washed, don't you think? I should think so. Now, what was the amount again? $3,429.47. I thought we were forgetting about the 47 cents, the relish burger. Yes, all right. Every penny counts, you know. Fletcher wrote the check for $3,429 payable to Linda Fletcher and signed it I.M. Fletcher in an illegible handwriting. There you are, Mr. Gillette. Thanks for stopping by. I'm sorry we're not on the seventh floor. It's been nice doing business with you, Mr. Fletcher. Standing at the door, Gillette still held the check between his thumb and index finger. Fletch noticed that his clothes were weirdly cut. The man had no pockets. No pockets at all. How did he get around without pockets? By the way, Mr. Fletcher, I read your piece in the magazine regarding what you termed the unfairness of divorce settlements, alimony in particular.